So these are the stories that you need to know about today. India and Russia, they're forging ties like never before. It's happening, by the way, as Russia is asserting its dominion, some would say, over old Europe. And by the way, why are Russia's leaders and India's leaders coming together today? Why are Mr. Putin and Mr. Modi meeting? Well, that has to do with the growth of what we're doing right here, as a matter of fact. Is that enough of a clue? Maybe I gave it away. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, on this very historic day, as India and Russia reassert their mutual commitments in terms of trade and culture, against all odds, by the way, we begin with what may have sparked this situation, at least in recent times. You see, Russia is gaining like never before in its struggle against the West. Unfortunately, what the West did has caused great pain and possibly even a collapse in Ukraine. Ukraine's loss, though, and the West's attempts to destroy Russia with frozen assets and with sanctions and with seizures and then with secondary seizures, it's ironically turned out to be Russia's gain. Don't think the world hasn't noticed, especially the Global South. You see, Global South countries have seen what Russia was able to do against crippling seizures and its funds being seized as well as its assets. And it's responding now accordingly. You know, there's a saying. My mom used to say this to me when I was a little kid growing up. She used to say a lot of things. I miss my mom. She'd say, "Son, that which doesn't kill you will make you stronger." I always remember her saying that. She said it in Spanish, of course. "Lo que no te mata, engorda," she would say. The West tried to kill Russia. But instead, as my mother would say, you know what it did? It made Russia stronger, stronger. And that is why in many ways, Russia is now more admired than ever before in places like Beijing, in places like Johannesburg and Tehran and Riyadh and Brasilia, and perhaps most of all, in Delhi. You see, Russia's relationship with India has blossomed like perhaps never before in recent years. India, perhaps as much of any other people in the world, respect overcoming. They respect self-sufficiency. It's in their DNA. It's in their DNA. It's part of the Vedic culture. It's their history. They call it something called Dharma. It's the eternal way, Dharma. Well, perhaps that's why today President Putin and Prime Minister Modi have come together, seemingly to proclaim to the world that this union between these two countries is simply not going to be broken. And joining us now is the perfect guest to talk about this. He's a former Foreign Secretary of India. He also served as India's ambassador to France, Egypt, Turkey, as well as right here in Russia, as a matter of fact. He also just penned this interesting article. It's called I've enjoyed reading it. It's called Why Putin's Visit Matters, Rebalancing India's Global Diplomacy. I welcome now Ambassador Kanwal Sibal to our show. Mr. Ambassador, thanks so much for joining us, sir.
My pleasure, Rick.
Do you agree with my premise that it seems like, at least for 23 years since these countries have been meeting, they've had good relationships, fair to model it at times, but I think there was a certain amount of respect that India may have gained from Russia's able to withstand what they received from the West. And maybe it kind of serves as an example in many ways?
Well, before I answer your question, let me give you a perspective.
Okay.
If you take the relationship between Russia and America, it has waxed and waned. It has never been stable. You take the relationship between Russia and China, it has gone through ups and downs, dramatic ups and downs. So you take the relationship between India and China, it also has been subject to really dramatic ups and downs.
Yeah.
The one relationship that has been stable, steady over decades is the India-Russia relationship. So it's not surprising, therefore, that President Putin is in India. And in the today's context, today's challenges, we are reinforcing what I see are longstanding, deep ties of understanding and mutual support over decades. And there is no geopolitical conflict between India and Russia. There never has been. For a short while, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and under President Yeltsin, there was some kind of a setback to the relationship. But it was very temporary, and it was not deep. It just is that Russia was trying to figure out what kind of a relationship it should have with the West and the non-West. But that period ended when President Putin came to power. And since 2020, we have had regular summits barring the COVID period between him and the Indian leadership. It's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable the strength, the depth of the relationship between India and Russia, which is why, for us, that Russia is standing up to Western pressures is extremely important for another reason. For us, Russia is a strong power. It's absolutely necessary to maintain a balance in international relations. Look, if Russia was knocked out of the global equations, what will the world look like? It will reinforce Western hegemony. And if the West and China manage to get together, it will effectively mean a G2, which nobody wants. So Russia is very critical. And for us, we are an Asian country. So we have to have a foot into Asia. And which are the two countries which are dominating Asia currently? It's Russia and China. Therefore, it is very important for us, two things. One, that we are in any form of multilateral, plurilateral organization within Asia, that we are part of it. That is SCO. BRICS actually also began between China, India, and Russia as a kind of a counterpoise to US unilateralism in order to have an Asia which was free from Western domination. We have very deep interests in Central Asia. So therefore, and finally, it is very important for us to have a very stable, deepening ties with Russia, because that's the only way to balance the Russia-China-India triangle.
Yeah.
Currently, the Russia-China triangle, part of the triangle, has become very strong. But we don't want to lose out on this, and therefore we want the India-Russia part of the triangle to remain very strong, so that Russia has options, we have options.
I want to get back to that in just a moment, because you say something about that in your essay, which I found interesting. But before I do that, I don't want to be like other people in my business and get too caught up in the optics. But I do think that I do believe that optics sometimes matter. So I'm going to ask my guys to pop up those pictures of again of the prime minister going to the airport. This is Palam Technical Airport Base. And he meets Mr. Putin personally. And then the two of them get in a car and ride away together. It seems to be a little bit of a break in protocol. How important is that, if at all?
It is. It's very important. First of all, as I said, President Putin has come to India many, many, many times, but he's never been received personally by any Prime Minister of India. This is the first time that the Prime Minister of India has gone to the airport to receive the Russian president. It is a very conscious, thought-out gesture with geopolitical intent also. It's not only bilateral, where he is giving honor to someone that he knows very well, to with whom he has interacted over the years very deeply and developed a personal rapport. It's also a geopolitical message that here the world, or the Western world, says he's a war criminal, he is to be isolated, and America is putting enormous pressure on us to dilute our relations with Russia. They have slapped 50% tariffs on us. 25% of that is because we buy the Russian oil. It's a message to the rest of the world, principally United States and Europe, that we look at our relations with President Putin very, very differently. Very, very differently. And we are not going to adjust our approach and thinking and policy towards Russia and President Putin, because you don't like it. You may have differences with Russia. Please manage your differences on your own.
Yeah.
Don't make us a victim of your differences. And we will look at our national interest, not in any sense of defiance, Rick, I must mention. It's not that we want to be petulant or defiant, nothing of the kind. It is that we have a very clear understanding of our national interest, both in the bilateral sense with Russia and in the larger geopolitical sense. And we will continue to give primacy to our national interest.
I almost get a sense, as I listen to you talk, you're a typical Indian in that you don't, the Indian culture is not based on a 24-hour news cycle. Unlike us Americans, you don't jump every time there's something new. It's almost like you're wise in your ways. I think the whole idea of, you know, the Vedic culture, which people don't understand in this world. Too many people think that India began with Gandhi. It didn't. I mean, I've been reading books lately that I have found absolutely fascinating, which some of your colleagues gave to me recently when I was in Valdai. I have really enjoyed these books because I've learned that this Vedic culture, the Indians were establishing ties with the Russians going back hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. I mean, they have found archaeological ties that goes back to the Vedic culture in Kazakhstan, obviously in Cambodia and other parts of the world. So, you know, this is not a culture that began yesterday. So the idea that Mr. Trump or any other Johnny-come-lately can tell the Indians what to do and they're not going to consider it through the premise of the thousands of years when their civilization has existed is almost foolhardy. And it seems to be what I almost hear you saying. We're not going to make decisions for today based on what someone told us yesterday.
Well, you know, we are in a difficult situation. It's not as if it is easy for us because at the end of the day, our relationship with the United States is very deep, very vast, profound. And in fact, in most ways, much deeper. If you look at it in terms of parameters, deeper than we have with Russia. But that's neither here nor there. That's neither here nor there because it's not an either-or situation. It's not the Cold War mode where we have to choose between United States and Russia. We want good relations with America. We will look for opportunities to expand them and deepen them, but not at the cost of our ties with Russia or anybody else that the Americans tell us not to have good relations with. And if there is a price to pay, we will be willing to pay that price. Because at the end of the day, we have to look at the future. And remember, Rick, we are now a rising power. We are already the fourth largest economy in the world. And by the 2027, we'll be the third largest economy. And if you look ahead at IMF predictions, World Bank predictions, by other American banks and all that, we are slated actually to become the second largest economy in a couple of decades. But if we become $15, $18, $20 trillion economy in real terms, our weight in the international system will increase. Now, Russia is also looking ahead. They are looking at a different India. It's not the India of the early 2000s. It's a different India with its 1.4 billion people, a lot of human talent, economically rising at over 7%, has a lot of technologies at its command, actually can help scale up the technologies that others are trying to develop because we have that kind of people, the number of people involved in artificial intelligence, semiconductors, critical and emerging technologies in all areas, robotics. Other countries have technologies, but they can't scale them up. They don't have the numbers available. We have those numbers. So there is a community of interest. I think Russia is looking ahead, rightly so. Putin is looking ahead, rightly so. And we are also looking ahead because Russia remains a powerhouse in so many ways, so many ways. Look, it's the largest country in the world.
Yeah.
Biggest country in the world.
Hydrocarbons.
Largely self-sufficient. Energy, water,
food,
technology, everything they have. So it's not as if their survival. And then, of course, a formidable nuclear power can defend itself. So it doesn't mean that they need anybody else for sheer survival. They can survive.
But let me ask.
So therefore, we have a long-term interest in investing in a country which has that kind of those kind of attributes and can contribute not only to our development, but to stabilizing the politics and geopolitics of Asia and the world.
But the United States is, in many ways, my country. And by the way, I should mention something. I thought about this as I was listening to you. The idea that Donald Trump wants to punish India for being, my word, friendly with Russia, while at the same time, he has become extremely friendly with Russia. Spending more time with Mr. Putin or sending his advisors and envoys to spend time with Mr. Putin than any other president in the last 10 years. So it's almost like doublespeak, isn't it?
Well, this is nothing new, Rick. I mean, we've been talking about double standards now for how many, 2-3 decades? Because there's one standard for the Western countries and another standard for others. And today you see that actually the Western countries are violating their own standards, their own values, and everything else. And that, again, is double standards.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the double standards were that we had certain values which were sticking to you, but you are
do what
not
I say,
doing.
Not what I do.
And now they're themselves violating those standards that they gave to themselves. So
I was just being told something by my crew. Gene, what were you trying to tell me? I'm sorry. Is there a new video coming in that we need to make note of? Is that what you were saying? Oh, okay. We've got some new pictures coming in. I don't even know what this is, but maybe, Mr. Ambassador, can you tell us what we're looking at here?
It's a flower arrangement. There's a typical flower arrangement. You know, if you came to Delhi, you will see whenever there is a foreign visitor, our municipal corporation, our gardeners and all that, they are extremely talented. They make animals, peacocks, this, that, full of flowers, huge, huge flower arrangements, very impressive. And here they have done that, you know, to just give a little beauty to the surroundings. India, Delhi is full of flowers in winter.
He's welcoming him now to the house where they're going to begin their talks. Apparently, they're going to have some discussions for several hours. And I understand that they're going to be talking about everything from, I made note of it here, they actually listed trade, economy, science, technology, and culture. 23rd year of the summit as they come together to have these discussions. Let's you and I talk about the problem, though. Here's the problem. And in fact, I'm going to quote you. This is what you wrote. You wrote, on the oil front, we do face a problem because of the sanctions imposed by Trump on two Russian oil companies supplying oil to India. Our private sector and government-owned refineries will willy-nilly reduce their purchases of oil from sanctioned Russian companies because of the U.S. secondary sanctions, which could damage their larger business and financial interests of access to the U.S.-dominated financial system. And then, by the way, then you go on to write, these sanctions are illegal. That these sanctions are illegal is neither here nor there. But the fact of the matter is they're there. What can India do, and I've read a lot about this recently, and what can Russia do to be able to bypass those sanctions, as they have in so many other cases, as the West continues to weaponize the dollar and its banking system, if anything?
Well, in this case, you know, the West is going to keep a very close eye on the movement of oil, on movement of ships, of the contracts that are being signed, and whether they violate the sanctions that they've imposed on Russian companies. There's, however, one saving grace before I go on to elaborate my answer, which is that all Russian companies have not been sanctioned. So India can still buy oil from non-sanctioned Russian oil companies. Huh. The volumes will go down, but the volumes won't disappear. Whether there's a reduction of 30%, 50%, we will see over time. So that is that's one aspect. The other problem is that even if you were to buy oil by this means or that means, they are also looking very closely at what they call this shipping, unauthorized shipping, whatever the word they use.
Yeah.
And they are monitoring that. They are monitoring that.
I think what you're referring to are non-licensed containers that don't have insurance, but they're used anyway, and it's a way of going around the system. I read about that. Yes.
Exactly, and then all the licensing is, and the insurance is done again where London is the biggest headquarters for global insurance of maritime shipping. So they'll have other means to try and squeeze the actual delivery of oil. You've just seen what the Ukrainians have done. They have attacked two
tankers
ships
in the Gulf.
Carrying oil because they were part of that list that the West has created. So there will be problems, but some oil will still come. But it's unfortunate because the absurdity in this is, and again we come to double standard. The Americans themselves told us that please continue to buy Russian oil, because if the Russian oil goes out of the international market, the prices will go up. Mm-hmm. And we want stable global prices. And so we went ahead and started buying discounted Russian oil. Now, this has been said publicly by the then U.S. ambassador to India while he was on post, and subsequently after retirement, he has said it more than two times that it's an absurd situation because we ourselves asked India to buy Russian oil. And the U.S. Commerce Secretary, the previous one, has said the same thing publicly, and is that very surprised that now the Trump administration is taking a very different position. There's no logic in what they're doing. Not at all. It is just muscle flexing, bullying, using levers to extract concessions from us on trade because they want to sell their soybeans, their corn, their agriculture products, their dairy products, because China stopped buying them. So, induce us to buy that, which we won't because we don't need them. And GMOs, there's no way India is going to buy American GMOs. So that's where the problem is. It is sheer, how should I say, bullying by without thinking about the medium to longer term costs of alienating India. We don't want our relationship with the United States to collapse at all.
Right.
But at the same time, we are not going to let him have his way on everything.
Yeah. And for the record, you're saying India will try to use every bypass, every backdoor, every go-around measure that it can find to continue to trade with Russia, particularly when it comes to oil. But even after doing all of that, there will still be, I hear you saying, some diminishment of its ability to get as much oil as it's getting now. Did I copy?
Look, Rick, we can always engage in rhetoric and say, no, we're going to stand our ground, we're going to defy this and we defy whatever we want. That's not how real life works. And so we will have to be careful in what we do because private companies are involved. We can't tell our private companies, you don't look at your wider interests and go ahead and keep buying Russian oil, even if there's a threat of these secondary sanctions, because their larger businesses will be hurt. We can't tell them. It is a decision they have to make. And so far as the public sector companies are concerned, they have deep interest in having access to the banking system. So they'll be also careful. So the government, to be frank with you, the government is not going to give them any direction, this way or that way. It will leave it to them, give them the responsibility to take decisions which actually are feasible and which they can live with. So if you buy Russian oil, very good. If there is a diminution, there's nothing much that government can do, but we will try and expand our trade ties with Russia in every other possible way, and in that sense, compensate for the lowering of the oil trade content in our bilateral relations, which has got jacked up in the last 4 years, phenomenally, because of a discounted Russian oil.
But this is still a form of weaponization, and it seems to me that the more that the U.S. and the West uses these forms of weaponization, either through SWIFT or through banking methods or through freezing assets or through, affecting currency and not allowing people to use certain currencies, like forbidding the ruble, for example, the more they do that, the more that the Global South community and the BRICS countries will come up, and they already have in many ways, will come up with ways to create alternative currencies, alternative banking methods, digital formats, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think it's just a matter of time before de-dollarization actually occurs? And in many ways, not that we don't want, I mean, I'm American, I want the dollar to remain valuable. I want the system the U.S. is has put in, which has been a very good system, except in recent years, they really have weaponized it to the point where my Chinese friends who I've interviewed and my sources there have told me it's weaponized to the point where we have to come up with alternative ways of doing business. Do you agree?
Yes, of course. Already, Russia-China trade, 98% of it is done in their respective national currencies.
Huh.
And the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said yesterday that 90, almost entirely the India-Russia trade now is being done in national currencies.
Hmm.
So already we are moving away from reliance on the dollar. We actually want to be able to use our national currencies in trading with all our partners because it saves a lot of money in terms of hedging against the dollar and everything else, right? And since our economy is growing, we are able to do that, and this phenomenon will continue. And then there is clearly a very considerable worry about the weaponization of the dollar and what it means, because this is a very powerful handle in the hands of an American president like Trump or anybody else, if they want to squeeze other countries. So you have to develop countermeasures. Now, to be realistic, it's not going to happen overnight. Even today, the large majority of global trade is being done in dollars, but the country will start chipping away at this. And therefore, to that extent, America has done a great disservice to itself by weaponizing the dollar and forcing other countries to look at alternatives. A lot of countries are now buying gold. So it's short-sighted, very short-sighted.
As a matter of
the other thing is that there's no control over what America does with the dollar. They can keep printing dollars, as they've been doing, and they can fuel inflation as a result of that. And they can use these excess dollars, by their corporation can use the excess dollars that are available to buy up assets abroad. So it helps their corporate sector a great deal, but it's creating a huge amount of indebtedness.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why Trump is disrupting everything is because he does not find an easy way to deal with U.S. indebtedness. And the one way he's found is this obsession with tariffs, imposed tariffs on everyone. Anyway, but to answer your question, you're right. This is a process that will continue. It'll be a relatively slow process, but it'll be a real process on the ground.
I read something yesterday that I thought you might find interesting. I was doing my research for a show I was doing yesterday, and I found that the dollar has gone down 50% in the last 3 years in comparison to gold. 50%, 50. That's crazy. When I read that, I thought to myself, I had no idea it diminished that much. Again, it's not the devaluation of the dollar. It's the devaluation of the dollar in comparison to gold over the last 3 years. Still, it's a substantial figure when you consider what is happening right now in the markets. You wrote at the end here, by the way, and I found this interesting. You said, and this goes back to the point I promised I'd get back to. You said, a trilateral Modi, Putin, Xi holding of hands causes a lot of flutter in the West. I was there. I don't know if you remember, but I was covering. We did our show live from the Shanghai Cooperative Summit. And when I saw those pictures of those three guys, talk about optics. And they, I think, were purposely trying to send a message to the West. Look at us. We are coming together. You made us come together. So now we're here, we're strong, and you can't divide us. That seemed to be what they were saying. You agree?
Well, let me say that I was myself involved when the idea of Russia, India, China trilateral group, which Primakov had conceptualized,
first went
into some kind of got a concrete shape. I was involved there. Hmm. The first meeting of the RIC countries was held. RIC foreign ministers was held in New York on the margins of the UN General Assembly when I was the first deputy foreign minister of India. So I've seen. I understand very, very well the thought behind it, the strategy behind it. Unfortunately, because India-China ties have remained unstable, we've not been able to get the maximum out of this trilateral grouping. If tomorrow, for any reason, if India and China resolve their problems together, then you can see what a formidable triangle that emerges on the global scene. And some of the problems that we are talking about will get addressed on their own when by this very, very powerful combination, including this de-dollarization and everything else. Now, but then, you know, there is a work I had to do in this regard. But hopefully, that since we are together members of BRICS and we are together in the SCO, we're together in the G20, everything else, that we can find ways of synergizing our respective capacities to be able to carve out space for ourselves in global governance and actually counter the hegemony that the West has enjoyed. The other interesting thing is that the Western hegemony was supported by the Transatlantic Alliance. Mm-hmm. It was the United States plus Europe. Japan, of course, was kind of made a member of that. It was basically that was the root of the Western hegemony. Mm. Now that there are attacks between the United States and Europe, in fact, in a sense, the situation has become more favorable in order to accelerate the dispersal of power within the system and achieve multipolarity. But for that, again, I'll come back that it's very vital that a solution to India-China problems is found. Now, may I say something which you haven't asked me, but I'd like to say
of course.
Which is this. I heard Dmitry Peskov say that we are ready for a no-limits partnership with India.
Yes.
That we are ready to go as far with India as India wants to go. Now, this phrase, a no-limits partnership was used some years ago when Putin went to Beijing and met Xi Jinping. And this created a huge concern in the West. And now if, let's say, this idea of a no-limits partnership is taken up between Russia and India, then you have two no-limit partnerships, Russia-China, Russia-India. And this is going to worry the West far more than what you just showed, this bonhomie between the three at Tianjin. Because that no-limits partnership, if that phrase becomes part of the official lexicon, it'll have very, very deep resonance geopolitically.
Do you think that's why Donald Trump is working his way back into the good graces of Russia?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, he has said that. He has said that, that he wanted to de-link Russia from China so as to be able to concentrate on China. Well, that didn't work, although the latest signs are that things are sort of perhaps improved a little bit. Since that didn't work, he reached out to Xi Jinping, started flattering him, started talking about a G2, described his meeting with him as a G2. Therefore, he thought he'll work at the other end. Woo China so as to break its very close ties with Russia.
It's like high school. It's like girlfriend, boyfriend kind of stuff in high school.
Exactly. These are just games. I mean, these have to be thought through very, very carefully in the longer term perspective, not like this.
But in the end, I think a lot of it is going to come down to what happens in Ukraine. It's starting to look, and I hate to say this because I feel terrible for the people of Ukraine, but it's starting to look like things are dissipating in Ukraine. Some people are even talking about, you know, the collapse of the government. And today I'm even reading articles that given nothing else to do, Russia will continue on to Odessa. So that war eventually is going to end, and it's looking like it's going to end very soon. It's going to leave the EU and the Europeans with egg on their face. It looks terrible for them. Not to mention they have their own scandal now, their own corruption scandal they're dealing with. So this whole thing is looking like, in the end, Russia can only end up being maudlin to better, but not negative. It's probably going to be a win for Russia in some ways, especially as the U.S. starts to reestablish ties with it when this war does finally come to an end. That will end up probably playing well for India, because if the United States removes those secondary and tertiary and primary sanctions, I imagine then that that's going to open up that relationship with Russia and India a little bit more. So you must be sitting on the sidelines going, you know, let's get this thing over with. It'll be good for our relationship in the end, notwithstanding the poor people of Ukraine, who I feel terrible about.
Well, you know, Russian diplomacy is very hard-headed, very, very deeply studied, a lot of patience, a lot of depth in their diplomacy. And therefore, they're playing their cards very well. And probably they understand very well, not probably, surely they understand very well that dealing with Trump is not easy. He's very unpredictable. He's volatile. He can change his position. He's very loose in his vocabulary. He doesn't realize that the words coming from a U.S. president have meaning, have resonance.
Yeah.
And people then draw conclusions from it. The fact that President Putin continues to be very favorable, be inclined towards Trump and giving him space and conveying a sense of confidence in him and his desire to actually promote a solution at one level, to me, comes somewhat as a surprise, because Putin would know that Trump is capable of changing his position. And then some of the things he says, you know, are things that are going to happen not in the foreseeable future, which is a lifting of sanctions or investing in the Russian economy or things like that.
But all that, Mr. Ambassador, notwithstanding, how important would it be for India for this situation with Ukraine to finally get resolved? And why?
Very good. Because we have been saying right from the start, as representatives of the Global South, in fact, when the G20 meeting took place in India, we played, a very deft diplomatic role in getting a consensus on many things and projecting the concerns of the Global South that what is happening in the Ukraine conflict is actually inflicting a lot of uncertainties on the Global South in the sector of energy and food supplies, fertilizers, and trade and what have you. And therefore, if a solution could be found, the problem globally could be eased. And therefore, we are invested in the idea of a peaceful resolution of this conflict as quickly as possible. Our Prime Minister has spoken to President Putin frequently on this matter. In fact, President Putin is keeping our side regularly informed.
Really?
Of developments. Oh, yes. Of what is happening on the Ukraine front. And India has said that we can be helpful in any way you want us to be. Our Prime Minister traveled to Kiev, met Zelensky, made that awful train journey, God knows how long and hours it takes, and he was not treated too well. That's a different matter. But he went there in order to promote the idea of peace. He remains in touch with Zelensky, but with the idea of creating a favorable atmosphere for a peaceful solution by conveying the concerns of the Global South. Now, if tomorrow there is a resolution, certainly it will be very helpful to India, and it will make our relationship both with Russia and the United States easier to handle, certainly.
Well, and one would think, right? I mean, I'll do this logical enthymeme for you. The war ends, the sanctions end, the secondary sanctions end, the flow of oil between India and Russia is sanctioned legally, and the problem goes away. That means the trade between Russia and India will improve subsequent to this war coming to an end. Did I get that right?
I think we need to improve our trade figures irrespective of what happens on the oil front. Remember, before the Ukraine war, before 2022, only 1% of our oil supplies came from Russia. For the simple reason that the biggest sources of oil are right next to our borders in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So they are far more economical for us to get oil from the Middle East.
So what changed?
But this once discounted Russian oil came on the market, it was a bonanza for us. And therefore, it went up to almost 38, 40% of our supplies.
Got it.
Now, with a change in the situation, that volume can come down. But it's extremely important that in other areas where India now has the capacities to cater to the Russian market, we are able to trade more. There are a lot of things that we can supply to Russia, especially in the current situation where Russia is facing sanctions. And we have identified those areas. And we are now negotiating a free trade agreement between India and the Eurasian Economic Union, which will also, on the margins, help in opening up the larger Russian Central Asian market to us.
Yeah,
but that could go on irrespective of what happens on the oil front.
And I don't want to blow the mind of our viewers and make them do math, because I get a headache doing math, too. I'm more of a writer. But it's really ironic that by telling the Indians they can't buy Russian oil, they actually are forcing up the price of oil, which makes that more money for Russia in a roundabout way. But it's that's another conversation. I want to ask you about this. This is interesting because, you know, as you know, I've worked at NBC and RT. I've worked in CNN, and I've worked at Fox News. I've been pretty much run them all. I've been a journalist almost all of my life and dedicated myself to fact gathering and trying to stay within the principles of balance and fairness. And I think that's what we try to offer with this particular show and RT in general. You get one perspective from the West, and it's not usually a perspective that's favorable for most of the countries in this part of the world. There's this forging now between Russia today and India, where there's going to be more of a presence there. How do you recognize that? How would you characterize the idea that we see more Indian media in Russia, more Russian India in India and in other parts of the world, for what it's worth?
Well, I think this was needed. This was needed, and I congratulate RT for having taken this initiative, because one way to develop people-to-people ties is to inform each other better, inform the public in each country better. And the only way to do that is essentially through the media. Some other channels can be used, but the media is most important. The other thing, Rick, is very, very important, and I want to mention that unfortunately, and President Putin reflected that in his interview with Tucker Carlson, the narratives, the global narratives, are controlled by the West, which means the narrative about Russia in India comes from the West. It's Reuters, AP, what have you, BBC. So our listeners actually are fed information from the West about what is happening in Russia, and it is very negative and critical.
You're biased.
And in fact, in many ways, this demonization of Putin and Russia, it gets reflected in the kind of information that comes to India. Of course, the Indians have their own mind. They can separate the wheat from the chaff, but nevertheless, it does influence their thinking and minds. Therefore, if RT comes to India and projects news which are of interest to the Indian audience,
more balanced,
I think it'll be great service done to India-Russia ties. But let me add something, and I mean this genuinely.
Okay.
RT is a very well-regarded channel in India. It has great readership, listenership, and in fact, the programs you present and the line you take is extremely refreshing because it is impartial, objective, informative. I mean, there are no Russian nationalists sitting on RT TV who are projecting the nationalist line. It's not like that at all.
Not at all.
It's very balanced and very mature. Very balanced and very mature.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm very happy that you've taken the initiative. But let me add a personal note to this, which is this, that my wife watches only RT and virtually nothing else.
That's the greatest compliment we can get.
And she admires you. Honestly, I'm telling you, she always looks at your programs.
Oh, that's so nice of her to say. What is her name?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth. Thank you, Elizabeth. That's so kind of you. We thank you for watching. It makes me feel good that you're letting me into your home. Well, Mr. Ambassador, what a wonderful conversation we have had. It's an absolute delight to talk to somebody like you with the wealth of experience, all that you've seen and all that you've done, especially on this historic day as Russia and India kind of forge this relationship and announce it to the entire world. Thank you, sir, for taking time to
thank
be
you,
with
Beth.
Us. I really, really thank appreciate you, it. You're a good man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I met you at the 100th anniversary of RT at the Bolshoi.
That's right. That's right.
And I shook hands with you.
I remember this morning when my team, we were talking about the show, and I mentioned that to them, that we'd had a chance to meet. So thank you again, sir. And thank you for taking time for us. And thank you for being with us. You can watch me on YouTube, by the way. Much of this conversation will appear on Journalistically Speaking, our YouTube channel. And please leave your comments. Tell us what you agree with or disagree with. We enjoy both. Also, you can find us on X at Rick Sanchez TV, where we have very fulsome conversations and plenty of critics. Thanks for being with us, nonetheless. We'll be looking for you next time. And once again, thank you for letting us into your homes.